Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 819. Its title is Proxy War and the Earth Island Boogie, or subtitled, What the Hell Does Dave Emery Mean by Underground Reich, Part 3. This is being recorded on November, and today is 13th, that's the name, of 2014. When you get to be old than I am, the time passes very quickly. Again, 11, 13, 2014. Now, this program is going to be a little bit different in that I have a lot of material to read, so I'm just going to go ahead and breeze through this as best I can in 1 hour. There will be no sides one and two. People can go ahead and edit. People who want to air it later can edit it into two sides. The program is going to be featuring in large measure my reading of the concluding chapter to a recent book. That book is by author Peter LaVenda, the author of the book Unholy Alliance that I have used in the past. It is titled, the book that is, The Hitler Legacy, The Nazi Cult in Diaspora, How It Was Organized, How It Was Funded, and Why It Remains a Threat to Global Security in the Age of Terrorism. And this is the last chapter of the book, posted on the disinfo.com website. It's titled The Skorzeny Syndrome, and it is basically the last chapter of the book. I want to emphasize that at this point in time, as of 11/13/2014, I have not read the book, so I cannot speak for the book itself. However, the last chapter of the book, which is in many ways a summation, probably comes as close as anyone could to summing up some of the key points of the research that I have done over the decades, almost four decades now. I'm in my 36th year on the air. We're going to be talking about the Third Reich going underground, which it most assuredly did. If that seems crazy, the Mafia began as a resistance movement in 12th and 13th century Sicily to first Viking, then Saracen invaders. It exists to this day. So does the Third Reich. However, it went underground, infiltrated U.S. intelligence. It controls all of corporate Germany, much of corporate America through cartel agreements. It controls the Republican Party through the Crusade for Freedom. Its influence could not be exaggerated. In particular, as a supplement to this program, people should examine AFA program number 22. It's called The Terror Connection, Part 1, The Skorzeny Connection, and Otto Skorzeny. And that, again, is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. There are many names you're going to hear here. A few concepts to introduce briefly, because we've got a lot to cover. The Earth Island is something that geopoliticians have long focused on. You will also hear it referred to as the World Island. It is that mass of territory stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar in the Atlantic all the way across Europe, much of the Middle East, Russia, China, and India. It is one contiguous landmass. It contains most of the world's land, most of the world's population, most of the world's natural resources, including and especially oil. And geopoliticians have long looked for the Earth Island or the World Island and controlling of it as a vehicle for world domination. Stretching across the middle of that, and particularly including much of the area that produces petroleum and fossil fuels, is a swath of Muslim population. And indeed, Muslims are a little more than a sixth of the world's population. Germany, both in World War I and in World War II, looked to the Muslim world as proxy warriors against imperial powers that they were fighting against, such as Russia and then the Soviet Union, and also France and Britain. At the end of World War II, World War II, the U.S. picked up the same concept of using Islamists and others as proxy warriors. One of the mistakes that this country made is that those same proxy warriors are also going to be used by the underground. Like, in fact, they're already being used against us, and ultimately I think they are going to contribute to America's demise and or destruction. You will hear names like François Genoux, the heir to the political last will and testament and collected literary writings of Martin Bormann, Adolf Hitler, and Joseph Goebbels, deeply involved with the Bank Al-Taqwa, among other things. There is no direct mention of the Muslim Brotherhood here, but that looms very large in the discussion. Also, the concept of the werewolves. Those were guerrillas that were set up to fight the Allied advance by the Nazis in World War II. There is discussion of that at the end of AFA program number 2 in on the SpitfireList.com website. After reading most of the chapter, the last chapter of Hitler's Legacy, or the Hitler Legacy by Peter Lavenda, I'm going to read as much as we have time to read of an interesting post by Robert Kaplan, who is a professor at Cornell University, on the Gatestone Institute website, that is a conservative website. He notes the extent to which U.S. foreign policy lately has been basically to bring to power Islamist governments in much of what had been the Ottoman Empire. He also notes that just as there is an Islamist glove inside of the Islamist hand inside of the American glove, so to speak, there in turn is a German hand inside the Ottoman hand, or Islamist hand inside of the American glove. I know that's complicated. We have a lot of material to talk about. I cannot stress strongly enough that people use the SpitfireList.com website. Use some of the tags in the description for the record 819, and that will help you along. You'll also, by the way, hear mention of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. He held the rank of general in the Waffen-SS. He was the political mentor to Yasser Arafat and also deeply involved with the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Third Reich formed numerous Muslim combat units to fight alongside the Nazis, and also to an extent alongside the Japanese as well. So that is what we have on tap. And again, we're going to read from the last chapter of The Hitler Legacy by Peter Lavenda, the subtitle, The Nazi Cult and Diaspora, How It Was Organized, How It Was Funded, and Why It Remains a Threat to Global Security in the Age of Terrorism. The last chapter, Hitler's Legacy, The Skorzeny Syndrome by Peter Lavenda. And Otto Skorzeny was the SS colonel who was Hitler's commando and in many ways the person who developed the operational template for modern terrorism. I can't recommend strongly enough that listeners to this program use AFA 22 to supplement their understanding. Much of that book came from the book Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando by Glenn Infield, published in hardcover by the St. Martin's Press, and we use that heavily, and Peter Lavenda begins his discussion with a quote from that book. The quote reads, Terrorism, the Skorzeny syndrome, is flourishing in the modern world, a reminder that Hitler and Nazism are still taking their toll more than three decades after the Third Reich collapsed. The above quotation is from Glenn Infield's biography of Otto Skorzeny, published in 1981, and the facts are as true today as they were then. Infield writes of the relationship that existed between Skorzeny and Yasser Arafat, for instance, and reminds us how Skorzeny advised the PLO and Al-Fatah from his base in Cairo. Infield knew and interviewed Skorzeny, and the biography of Hitler's commando is relevant to any contemporary study of the origins of modern terrorism. What the world has been experiencing since at least 2001, and certainly for years earlier than the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, has been what analysts refer to as asymmetrical warfare conducted by non-state actors. This is a technique that was developed to perfection by Skorzeny and the other leaders of what we have called Odessa. The fact that the Western intelligence agencies turned a blind eye to Skorzeny's activities has contributed to our inability to confront and defeat what we have called Islamist terrorism. Arms dealing, covert international banking systems, targeted assassinations, terror bombings, the strategy of tension as it was described and defined by fascist terrorist Stefano Della Chiaia, already existed as part of an underground terror network long before Al-Qaeda was born. After World War II, the American people thought that Nazi Germany had been defeated and the war, unquote, was over. This book demonstrates that it never was. Instead, we were told that communism was the new threat and we had to pull out all the stops to prevent a communist takeover of the country. And so our military and our intelligence agencies collaborated with surviving Nazis to go after communists. We refused to pursue worldwide right-wing terror groups and assassins. After all, they were killing communists and leftists. They were doing us a service. Like J. Edgar Hoover and the Mafia, the CIA refused to believe that the Nazi underground existed, even as they collaborated with it via the Galen Organization and the like. The whole thrust of this book has been that American leaders in business, finance, media, and politics collaborated with Nazis before, during, and after World War II. The West's share in the blame for Al-Qaeda et al. Goes back a long way, before Eisenhower, to a cabal of extremist U.S. general army generals and emigre Eastern Europeans who didn't have much of a problem with Nazism since they feared communism more. The Vatican, the Tibetans, the Japanese, the Germans, the Croatians, and the Americans all felt that communism was the greater danger long before World War II. We enlisted war criminals to fight on our side. We appropriated the idea of global jihad from the Nazis and their World War I predecessors in the Kaiser's Germany. We amped up their plan to weaponize religion and convince Muslims who hated each other to band together to fight communism. And when Afghanistan was liberated and the Soviet Union was defeated, September 11th, 2001. Our cynical exploitation of religion has delivered a hideous stream of blowback that threatens the world still. With the Nazi diaspora, the leaders of the Third Reich who had survived, who were either living underground or were, quote, denazified, unquote, and living freely above ground, constituted a government in exile. They remained in contact, reinforced each other's beliefs, provided logistical support where possible, and kept the faith alive. They became involved in political and military intrigues around the globe, always with the goal of causing an imbalance in global power structures. Motivated by anti-Semitism, they collaborated with Arab leaders and guerrilla organizations in attacks against Israel, even going so far as to develop weapons systems in Egypt. They wrote propaganda against Israel and against Jews in general, repeating the same libels as before. They formed neo-Nazi groups in Europe, Latin America, North America, and elsewhere, cultivating a forming new generation of followers on every continent. They support Holocaust deniers and right-wing extremists everywhere, even when they do not agree on all points. They found official positions within extremist governments in the Middle East and Latin America. In addition to a government in exile, they also constitute an army in exile. They train troops, including security forces, in interrogation and torture, and ran guns. They conspired to assassinate objectionable leaders in various countries, as well as those who betrayed their own network. They developed weapons of mass destruction long before the identical claim was laid at the door of Saddam Hussein. They are non-state actors like Al-Qaeda, with the difference that they recently had a state. They conduct asymmetric warfare because they can no longer field battalions made of tanks and planes and submarines and no longer really need to do so. Using terror as a weapon has proved to be far more effective. They move money silently and unseen through the world's financial institutions. People like Jarmar Schacht, the finance minister of Nazi Germany, and François Genoux wrote the book. And they are loosely organized. Individual units possess a certain degree of deniability, something that newer terror groups have copied. Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, Fatah, Jamaat Islamiyah, Lashkar-e-Taiba, etc. are all children of Odessa. The pact between Nazi anti-Semitism and Arab anti-Semitism was made with Haji Amin al-Husseini all those years ago and has been renewed every decade since with refinements as necessary to reflect emerging political realities in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union. Skorzeny, al-Husseini, Genoux. One big, happy family. Emboldened by the defeat of the Red Army in Afghanistan, aided and abetted by CIA, the militant forces of that remote yet deadly landscape turned their attention on the West. Repudiating Western decadence and liberalism, the Taliban enforced strict and even idiosyncratic interpretations of Sharia law. Proponents of the Third Way, the Taliban, were equally disgusted with Soviet atheism and communism and with American materialism and liberalism. Yet they won the war against the Soviet invasion using asymmetric warfare. They were not able to field armored divisions, but had to wage a long and exhausting guerrilla war against helicopter gunships, tanks, and rockets. Asymmetric warfare is usually defined as a conflict between two dramatically unequal forces. The war of the U.S. and Vietnam is given as one example where the vastly superior, in terms of economy, numbers, and military strength, U.S. forces fought the guerrilla forces represented by the Viet Cong and the regular North Vietnamese forces represented by the Viet Minh. Often the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is given as another example, with the army and air force of the Israeli military opposed to the various guerrilla factions represented by the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, plus those of Hamas and Hezbollah. In most, if not all, cases of asymmetric warfare of the last 100 years or so, it has often been of a powerful Western country embroiled in a conflict with numerically and economically weaker non-state actors, in which the current problem with Al-Qaeda and ISIL, which the current problem with Al-Qaeda and ISIL seems to represent. In these cases, the non-state actors are fighting for their own territory, language, ethnic identity, etc., often against a colonial or former colonial power such as England, France, the Netherlands, Spain, etc. There is one type of asymmetric warfare that is usually not recognized or included in this phenomenon, however. It is when a powerful state loses its power, yet continues to fight the forces that defeated it using the same means as non-state actors, such as terrorism and assassination. There is, to my knowledge, only one such example in the modern world, and that is Nazi Germany. Nationalism is a hallmark of the type of terrorism we have come to experience in the post-World War II period. It was actually given a form and an agenda by the Nazis, who created the werewolf concept, a stay-behind guerrilla force that would use asymmetric tactics to wage war against the Allies. This was an example of a state that refused to cease hostilities even after defeat. Another type of asymmetric actor is the religious ideologue. As has been pointed out in studies of terrorism, particularly since the events of September 11, 2001, this new type of adversary may not be identified with a single ethnicity or geographic territory. Even though the origins of the violent religious terrorist may be found in the post-colonial period, the nature of the conflict has changed considerably since then. What many fail to realize is that the ideology of the Nazi Party, particularly as refined by the SS, was essentially a spiritual ideology. I have made the point elsewhere that the Nazi Party, in and of itself, was a cult. To try to understand it as a purely political entity in a modern American context is to make a grave mistake. The Nazi network that was formed in the last days of the war and which has existed in one form or another in the 70 years since then is comprised of both a nationalist and a religious agenda. The Nazi Party has its origins in esoteric Arianism, such as represented by the writings of Guido von Liszt and Lanz von Liebenfels, as well as occultist groups such as the Armannenschaft, the Germanenorden, and the Thulergesellschaft, or Gesellschaft. These groups combined racist ideology with spiritual, mystical ideas and practices, some of which were adapted from more mainstream esoteric groups such as the Theosophical Society and the writings of its founder, Helena Blavatsky. The social Darwinism that is one of the hallmarks of the Nazi regime is the outer court, unquote, of the spiritual Darwinism that is clearly elucidated in Blavatsky's works. What this means is that Nazism is just as much a spiritual philosophy as it is a political one. Thus, the basic components of the non-state actor in asymmetric warfare are present in the Nazi underground, what we have been calling Odessa. The terrorist acts perpetrated by this underground are precisely those of the modern non-state actors with which we have all become familiar. The motivation for Odessa runs parallel to that of Islamist terror organizations, a spiritual viewpoint that both organizations wish to impose on the modern world through the medium of terrorism, assassinations, and the like. Both ideologies are exclusive rather than inclusive. Both are anti-Semitic, both are anti-American, and deplore what they see as Western decadence, unquote. One could make a very good case that Hitler's objection to modern art, modern music, and modern culture in general is virtually identical to the point of view of Islamist critics concerning the same. In addition, and this may be more important than it seems at first glance, many members of the SS and the Wehrmacht converted to Islam after the war and found employment and residence in Muslim countries. In some cases, they actively supported Arab regimes in their opposition to the State of Israel by providing technical expertise, engineers, and training in interrogation, espionage, and related arts of war. I believe this provides an important perspective into the current terrorist phenomenon, as it shows a continuity of purpose combined with tactical and operational methods that have their origin in the murky world of the first days of the Cold War, when a cynical manipulation of religion using non-state actors took place under the aegis of a decades-long and often poorly thought-out campaign of state-sponsored anti-Semitism. The choices the U.S. made as a country in the immediate post-war period have resulted in the current state of affairs where terrorism, Islamism, and other forms of asymmetric conflict are concerned. To quote Glenn Infield again, it has become evident during recent years that major wars in the nuclear age will be fewer than those in the past, but individual and group terrorism will increase steadily. Skorzeny and his commandos during the Third Reich and Skorzeny and his Odessa members during the post-war years were leaders in modern-day terroristic tactics. Skorzeny's followers and students adhere to his teachings today. It was Skorzeny and his colleagues in Odessa who, as early as 1950 and the outbreak of the Korean War, proposed forming a bloc of non-aligned nations in Asia, Africa, and Latin America to stand up to America and Russia, exactly the same position taken by Indonesia's Sukarno 5 years later. The position of the Islamist theoreticians of today is not dissimilar. The difference is that the Soviet Union has already fallen. While China may develop into a threat, Uzbek, Uyghur, and other activists in Western China are creating another Muslim front with the intention of destabilizing that regime. Seen as both communist and capitalist, China could be an interesting adversary for the third-way position of contemporary Nazism. China is at least as nationalist as its former enemy, Japan. As for Japan itself, it has recovered remarkably since the devastation of the Second World War and two atomic bombs. Japan and Germany are economic powerhouses. Even though Japan has been struggling in recent years, it is still one of the most prosperous nations in the world. As for Germany, it has developed exactly as planned so long ago. It is reunited, and the leader of the European Union, easily its most powerful and influential member. It is true that growing numbers of immigrants from Eastern Europe, and especially Muslim immigrants from Turkey, the Balkans, and North Africa, are providing an environment where questions concerning German identity and responsibilities are being raised. But as German cities have been rebuilt, industrial growth is strong, and memories of the war are fading with each new generation, it is doubtful whether any serious soul-searching will occur. With tensions rising in Europe over the fate of Ukraine and the Russian annexation of Crimea, it may be that the world will look to Germany again to provide the buffer between the newly aroused Russia and the much more vulnerable nations of Eastern and Southern Europe. It is doubtful whether the world will once again be confronted with jackbooted stormtroopers wearing swastika armbands singing the Horst Wessel song. But that does not mean that Nazism has disappeared. It has merely changed uniforms and moved to a different theater of operations. I do not wish to deprive the Islamic groups of agency in their present conflict with the West, but it is important to emphasize that they were as manipulated and exploited by the Germans in two world wars as they had been by the colonial powers themselves. The concept of global jihad was foreign to Islam until created by a German spy, ironically of Jewish ancestry no less, with a view towards using Muslims as proxy soldiers in Germany's fight with the Allied forces of England, France, and Russia. And when the Cold War began, they were manipulated once again, this time by American intelligence efforts to weaponize them and Islam against the Soviet Union. To continue the struggle against the Western world that was begun by Westerners themselves for motives that had nothing to do with Islam or with genuine jihad is to cooperate in Western strategies that will only result in the destruction of more Muslim lives and the desolation of more Arab lands. This is especially true with regards to Palestine. The Palestinians themselves must realize that no assistance is coming their way from the vastly wealthier and populous Arab world. The devastation of Gaza and the ongoing occupation of the West Bank is the legacy of decades of Arab indecision and manipulation. It is obviously far more beneficial to have the Palestinians live in squalor and die in refugee camps than to have the Arab nations work together to create a more productive solution. The Arab leaders have long since realized that the Nazi and Zen ideals of heroic death on the battlefield are dated notions, suicidal and non-productive, that can only end in annihilation. Yet they tolerate and even encourage the raging anti-Semitism of Hitler, Goebbels, and von Mises because it directs Palestinian anger towards Israel and the U.S. and away from the Arab leaders themselves, who have found themselves in an increasingly vulnerable situation since the revolts of the Arab Spring. Palestinian suicide bombers, however, have looked towards Hitler and Haj Amin al-Husseini as avatars of the new Islam, of the desire to create a caliphate that will stretch from Jerusalem and Mecca all the way to Southeast Asia, Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta, and yes, even to Sumbawa. We are still fighting World War I, and we will continue to fight it. We are redrawing the world map once again in lines of blood and steel. America should be at the forefront of the fight to end these conflicts, but our moral leadership has been called into question again and again. We've made mistakes at the end of World War II. We sided with the colonial powers when we should have made common cause with the indigenous peoples of the Middle East, Africa, and Asia who looked to us as their natural allies. We enlisted the aid of Nazis and Nazi war criminals to accelerate our space program and to field espionage agents against the Soviet Union. We allowed dedicated and committed anti-Semites with a history of violence and bloodshed against civilian populations to run freely in developing nations, training torturers and assassins. We acted out of fear. We co-opted our values, trading them for greater security. This fear is also the Hitler legacy. We thought we could control the devil that was the Nazi Party and the SS, using them to protect ourselves against Russia. We used the strategies developed by the Germans in two world wars to coerce and cajole Muslim believers to declare a holy war that would one day be aimed at us. We lived up to the charges made against us by the Islamists, that we were without faith, bereft of spirituality, obsessed with materialism, cold enough to the summons of the soul that we could contemplate weaponizing religion, seeing it as just one more tool, one more element in our ever-growing arsenal of destruction. We could urge Muslims and Buddhists to risk their lives in attacks against our enemies, willing to fight to the last drop of their blood, using their faith and clumsy, awkward protestations of our own as the motivations for deadly, violent action when we had no moral, no legitimate right at all to demand this of them. Is it any wonder then that the blowback was so severe, the hatred so concentrated? The Odessa networks still exist, transforming softly from time to time, changing with every new political development on the world stage. There are names in the address book of Odessa Chief Hans Ulrich Rudel, R-U-D-E-L, of people who are still alive as this is being written. People scattered all over the world, devotees, true believers, carrying the torch in a virtual Nuremberg rally, feeling more and more comfortable by the day. New groups are being formed, new leaders chosen from among the faithful. Xenophobia is at an all-time high in Europe and increasingly here in America. The Internet has provided new and improved means of communication. Arab systems of money transfer such as Hawala are used to defeat the strictures of the international banking system made more severe after the events of 2001. The hysteria we used to feel about secret communists has been replaced by hysteria over terrorism. We lost our way briefly in the 1950s over communism, and innocent people were ruined, reputations destroyed. Now, again, we are equally paranoid to the extent that TSA agents pat down the elderly and infants in strollers. We are increasingly made to disrobe before we can board a plane, and we are thankful because this means that we will be safer. But if we want to, we can walk across the border into Canada or Mexico. As the political life of every country becomes more and more polarized between quote right unquote and quote left unquote, the men of Odessa can only laugh at our discomfort. When the Berlin Wall came down, many thought that the world had become a safer place. They did not realize that this was only one phase of the overall plan, the one that might have been hatched in Strasbourg in 1944 at the Maison Rouge Hotel, or not, but it was the plan. And when the Soviet Union fell, many patted themselves on the back thinking that history was at an end, that all serious conflict was over, except maybe for a little cleanup here and a little cleanup there. Nothing to worry about. Our side won. Dream on. That, again, is a reading of the basic almost all of the last chapter of Peter Lavenda's book, The Hitler Legacy, The Nazi Cult and Diaspora, how it was organized, how it was funded, why it remains a threat to global security in the age of terrorism. It is just out. And that last chapter is called Hitler's Legacy, The Skorzeny Syndrome. Again, I want to emphasize that there are many, many things in that particular discussion, I want to stress that listeners should use AFA program number 22, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, and the many, many programs about the Muslim Brotherhood. In the description for this show, there is a still photograph of some people pledging their allegiance to ISIS. There's also a link to the video from which the still photograph is taken. And they are basically giving the fascist salute. That is very revealing and part and parcel to the analysis that I just gave. There is no analogous gesture anywhere in the Muslim world. The fascist salute adopted by the Nazis was basically taken from the old Roman Empire. Again, there is no such counterpart in the Muslim world. So please, when opportunity presents itself, go to the description for the record program 819 and check out both the still photograph and the video from which it was taken. Now, we're also going to be reading an article. This was from the Gatestone Institute website. That is a conservative website. And this, in a sense, takes the concept that I just elucidated further in one sense and also at a somewhat narrower focus. Again, bear in mind the concept of the Earth Island. Bear in mind the mass of land stretching from the gates of Gibraltar, Straits of Gibraltar, excuse me, all the way across Europe, all the way across much of the Middle East, Russia, China, and India, has most of the world's land mass, most of the world's population, most of the world's natural resources, most of the world's oil. Stretching across the middle of it is a vast stretch of Muslim population. That was one of the things that led the Germans to use Islamists as proxy warriors in both world wars. We then picked up the same tactic. And those same proxy warriors are rebounding and are going to destroy us, barring a change in course and events. You're going to hear reference here to the Arab Spring. When the Arab Spring took place, I was, as is so often the case, going against the grain. I was talking about the fact that this was very obviously an intelligence operation. It was begun during the closing days of the George W. Bush administration. I predicted that far from bringing democracy to the Middle East, it would wind up bringing the Muslim Brotherhood to power, and ultimately they would be used as proxy warriors against Russia, China, and the U.S., and that it would wind up doing serious, if not politically fatal damage to President Obama and his administration. Just look at Benghazi, the pressure from grandstanders like John McCain over ISIS, both the development of ISIS and the attack on Benghazi, direct outgrowths of the Arab Spring, or the Muslim Brotherhood Spring, as I termed it in, for the record, 787. In that same series, I also noted that Tayyip Erdogan, the head of state of Turkey, was not the moderate Islamist that he was being represented as being, the non-think at the time. The party line at the time of the Arab Spring was that, well, these revolts will bring to power moderate Islamists like Erdogan in Turkey, and that will be just dandy. And I pointed out that, in fact, Erdogan was very sympathetic to, really part and parcel to, the Muslim Brotherhood, and that his political rise grew from the political rise of the Bank al-Taqwa. Bank al-Taqwa was an agent, basically an organ, I should say, of the Muslim Brotherhood, founded by Yusef Nada, a German intelligence agent in World War II, by most accounts, and also the fellow who, according to the Asia Times, helped the escape of Haji Amin al-Husseini from Germany at the end of World War II. Bank al-Taqwa had an account with unlimited line of credit for al-Qaeda, and in turn, François Janoux, the aforementioned François Janoux, was deeply involved with the Bank al-Taqwa. When the Operation Green Quest raids took place in March of 2002, the individuals and institutions raided were very close to A, the Bank al-Taqwa, B, Saudi Arabia, Arabia and Sea, and most importantly, the Republican Party and the administration of George W. Bush. Grover Norquist and Karl Rove are two of the principals involved in forging that alliance, and the Operation Green Quest raids were neutralized when Talat Otman, a director of George W. Bush's Harkin Energy Corporation and a close political friend and personal friend and advisor to both Georges Bush, a man who gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican convention in 2000, interceded directly with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. He did that on April 4th of 2002, about 2 weeks after the raid. A few months later, Paul O'Neill resigned from his position as Treasury Secretary. Many of the boots on the ground were from the Secret Service, which is under the direction of Treasury. And ultimately, Operation Green Quest was subverted. There's no mention of it today. I suspect that that is because the recent movie Killing the Messenger, about the suppression of Gary Webb's investigative journalism on the Contra involvement in the cocaine traffic, that talked about how the agency, CIA, that is, officials and others, basically were able to talk key journalists into suppressing the information or discrediting Gary Webb, because that would protect ongoing operations. I suspect that much the same thing happened with Operation Green Quest. You never hear about it, and there is abundant evidence that jihadist elements have continued to be supported by elements of Western intelligence, including elements of our own intelligence system in places like the Caucasus, Chechnya, and elsewhere. The Boston Marathon bombing, and also the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 appear to be part of the blowback from that. If some of what I talked about, some of what Peter Levender wrote about and I talked about in reading that seems far-fetched, just consider Afghanistan, where for years U.S. servicemen and women were involved in a bloody war stemming from the September 11th attacks against an enemy we created to go get the Soviet Union. Well, now that an enemy is fighting against us and is going to go get us as well. Back to Erdogan and Turkey. One of the things I've also spoken about in connection with Erdogan is the fact that basically he is an Islamic fascist and an imperialist as well. And what he is looking to do is to re-coalesce the Ottoman Empire. I'm going to read an article which, in a sense, not only talks about that, but one could speak of an Islamist-slash-Ottoman hand within the American glove of military and political power, and in turn, a German hand inside of the Islamist or Ottoman hand inside of the American glove. You're also going to hear mention of the fact that the International Criminal Court was not only a German creation, but is financed largely by Germany. This article is called "The U.S. Helps Reconstruct the Ottoman Empire." It's by Robert E. Kaplan, written on May 29th of 2013. It's on the Gatestone Institute website. That is a conservative website. Robert Kaplan is a professor at Cornell University, talking about recent U.S. military involvement in places like the Balkans and the Middle East. He writes, "Each of these United States military interventions occurred in an area that had been part of the Ottoman Empire and where a secular regime was replaced by an Islamist one. So far, the German policy of keeping hidden its leadership role in its attempt to reconstitute the Ottoman Empire has been highly successful. Since the mid-1990s, the U.S. has intervened militarily in several internal armed conflicts in Europe and the Middle East, bombing Serbs in Serbia in support of Izetbegovic's Muslim regime in Bosnia in 1995, bombing Serbs and Serbia in support of KLA Muslims of Kosovo in 1999, bombing Libya's Gaddafi regime in support of rebels in 2010. Each intervention was justified to Americans as motivated by humanitarian concerns to protect Bosnian Muslims from genocidal Serbs, to protect Kosovo Muslims from genocidal Serbs, and to protect Libyans from their murderous dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Other reasons for these interventions were also offered: to gain for the U.S. a strategic foothold in the Balkans, to defeat communism in Yugoslavia, to demonstrate to the world's Muslims that the U.S. is not anti-Muslim, to redefine the role of NATO in the post-Cold War era, among others. Each of these U.S. military interventions occurred in an area that had been part of the Ottoman Empire. In each, a secular regime was ultimately replaced by an Islamist one favoring Sharia law and the creation of a worldwide caliphate. The countries that experienced the Arab Spring of the 2010s without the help of American military intervention, Tunisia and Egypt, had also been part of the Ottoman Empire and also ended up with Islamist regimes. In the U.S., most discussions of the military conflicts of the 1990s in the Balkans and the Arab Spring of the 2010s do not mention that the areas involved had been part of the Ottoman Empire. These territories included Turkey, the Muslim-populated areas around the Mediterranean, Iraq, the coastal regions of the Arabian Peninsula, and parts of the Balkans. In the areas that experienced the Arab Spring, Turkey's role in every instance has been to support the rebels and quickly recognize them as the legitimate government of the country in upheaval. Turkish leaders do make the connections between the conflicts in Bosnia, the Arab Spring, and the Ottoman Empire. Harold Rhode, R-H-O-D-E, an American expert on Turkey, has reported, quote, "President Erdogan's recent electoral victory in 2011, beginning again, President of Turkey Erdogan's recent 2011 electoral victory speech puts his true intentions regarding Turkey's foreign policy goals in perspective. He said that this victory is as important in Ankara as it is in the capital of Bosnia-Herzegovina, Sarajevo, under Ottoman times, an important Ottoman city, that his party's victory was as important in a large Turkish city, Izmir, Izmir, on the western Anatolian coast, as it is in Damascus, and as important in Istanbul as it is in Jerusalem. In saying that this victory is as important in all of these former Ottoman cities, Erdogan apparently sees himself as trying to reclaim Turkey's full Ottoman past. The occurrence that since 1990, each European and Middle Eastern country that experienced American military intervention in an internal military conflict or an Arab Spring has ended up with a government dominated by Islamists of the Muslim Brotherhood or Al-Qaeda variety fits nicely with the idea that these events represent a return to Ottoman rule. Besides being a political empire ruling a territory and its population, the Ottoman Empire claimed to be a caliphate with spiritual suzerainty over all Muslims, those within its borders, as well as those beyond. Though it might seem strange at first, the idea of advancing the renewal of the Ottoman Empire on two tracks, breaking down the post-Ottoman political structure and promoting a caliphate which Islamists say they long for, is really quite reasonable. Just as the Balkan conflicts of the 1990s and the Arab Spring of the 2010s considered in historical perspective suggests that Turkey might be attempting to recreate its former empire, consideration of the Turkish Empire in historical perspective suggests the possible partnership of Germany with Turkey in that project, given that from its creation in 1870, the country of Germany viewed Turkey as it with its empire as a most valuable client and ally. In the view of the leaders of Germany, Turkey was controllable through a combination of economic intercourse, gifts of educational opportunities, provision of technical expertise and administrative aid, as well as bribes to Turkish officials. Germany saw influence over Turkey as a means of influencing Muslims worldwide for its own interests. Thus, as the German scholar Wolfgang Schwanitz has shown, during World War I, Germany employed the Turkish caliphate to promote jihad, riot and rebellion in areas where Muslim populations were ruled by its enemies, Russia, France, Britain, and Serbia. Yet in the 50-odd articles collected in an exploration of the awareness on the part of Americans of a possible Turkish connection with the Arab Spring, I found not a single mention of Germany. Only from a link in one of these articles to an article on the International Criminal Court, or ICC, which, with its indictment of Muammar Gaddafi and issuance of a warrant for his arrest, provided the legal basis legitimizing NATO's bombing of Libya, which gave the rebels their victory and ended the Gaddafi regime, did I find any mention at all of Germany. From that article, A Lawless Global Court by John Rosenthal from Policy Review of February 1, 2004, number 123, one learns that the ICC is a project initiated, promoted, and to a considerable extent funded by Germany. Given this, the idea that the ICC served Germany's purposes is common sense. Through the ICC connection, Germany's promotion of the Arab Spring is clear, yet it is never or almost never mentioned. This silence calls for an explanation. Later, I did come across an explicit reference to Germany's role in it, specifically in the war against the Assad regime in Syria, in John Rosenthal's article, German Intelligence, Al-Qaeda All Over Syria, in the online Asian Times, which reports that the German government supports the rebels and their political arm, the Syrian National Council, or SNC, against Assad. That the German government classified, made secret, by reason of national interest, the contents of several BND, German Foreign Intelligence, reports that the May 25th, 2012 massacre of civilians in the Syrian town of Hula, that's H-O-U-L-A, for which Assad has been blamed, was in fact actually perpetrated by rebel forces, and that, quote, the German Foreign Office is working with representatives of the Syrian opposition to develop concrete plans, unquote, for a political transition, unquote, in Syria after the fall of Assad. So far, the German policy of keeping hidden its leadership role in the attempt to reconstitute the Ottoman Empire seems to have succeeded. Each U.S. military action in Europe and the Middle East since 1990, however, with the exception of Iraq, has followed an overt pattern. First, there is an armed conflict within the country where the intervention will take place. American news media heavily report this conflict. The good guys, unquote, in the story are the rebels. The bad guys, unquote, to be attacked by American military force are brutally anti-democratic and committers of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. Prestigious public figures, NGOs, judicial and quasi-judicial bodies, and international organizations call for supporting the rebels and attacking the regime. Next, the American president orders American logistical support and arms supplies for the rebels. Finally, the American president orders military attack under the auspices of NATO in support of the rebels. The attack usually consists of aerial bombing, today's equivalent of the 19th and 20th century's gunboat, which could attack coastal cities of militarily weak countries without fear of retaliation. The ultimate outcome of each American intervention is the replacement of a secular government with an Islamist regime in an area that had been part of the Ottoman Empire. Why the government of the U.S. would actively promote German aims, but the destruction of Yugoslavia, both World Wars I and II saw Germany invade Serbia, and the recreation of the Ottoman Empire, is a question that needs to be answered. Indeed, again, that article by Robert Kaplan, a professor at Cornell University, I think, does more than raise questions. I think the answer, at least in part, can be found in the last chapter of Peter Levender's book, the vast bulk of which I read into the record to begin this program. An analogy that people might want to think about is the September 11th attacks, even though the aircraft that ultimately wound up crashing into the Twin Towers and into the Pentagon were still flying. They had been hijacked. And even though the flight was still underway, they were not to reach their destination. And I think that basically America could be compared to one of those planes that has been hijacked. Yeah, we're still flying, but what is intended by the people controlling the plane, what I call the Underground Reich, is not benign at all. And if we do not change course, we are going to be destroyed as well. By the way, also, at the end of the reading of the Pieper Lavenda chapter from Hitler, the Hitler Legacy, you heard reference to the Red House document, or Maison Rouge document. That was the meeting in August of 1944 at which SS General Dr. Scheib brought the Martin Bormann plans for the post-war underground Bormann capital network to key German industrialists. And never lose sight of the fact that when Dr. Scheib addressed the industrialists, he cited the Hamburg America Line, one of the Bush family's Nazi businesses, as exemplary of the type of concern, the type of business concern that had been most useful to Germany. And as we looked at in, among other programs, 273 and 791, the Bush family is deeply involved with the Bormann Network. I believe them to be the point element of the Underground Reich and the Bormann Network in the United States. He also heard reference to the third position. There are two miscellaneous archive shows on the SpitfireList.com website. Those deal with the fascist third position, which is a fascist ideological concept which seeks to unite left and right under a fascist political agenda. Anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism are two of the principal aspects of it, and it is a very important concept to study. Also, an overlapping concept is Yaquism. Francis Parker Yaqui was a key Nazi operative and formed a somewhat related political ideology that sought to incorporate third worlders and so-called progressive elements in a fascist agenda. I have numerous programs featuring interviews with Kevin Coogan, the author of the definitive biography on Yaqui called Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaqui in the Post-War Fascist International. And there are many references and text excerpts of that in the on the SpitfireList.com website. So please use that website. You might want to subscribe to the comments, too. There's a link at the top of each post and program that will permit you to subscribe to the comments, because there are very useful comments that are made by a contributing editor and other scholarly noteworthy individuals. This concludes For the Record number 819, titled Proxy War and the Earth Island Boogie, subtitled What the Hell Does Dave Emery Mean by Underground Reich, Part 3. This is being recorded on November 13 of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.